readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I'm so glad we're together for our weekly wander through the world of books. Moms, I hope you enjoyed your special day last Sunday, and this week's show is a slightly belated token of my esteem. We're going to look at the new selections aimed at the gals. Yes, sister, this one's for you. But hey, guys, don't tune out. There are some fun titles here for everyone, including Tina Fey's new book. And with the long Memorial Day weekend just around the corner, it's time to start thinking about which books you'll take to the beach. Okay, ready? Let's take the plunge into titles everybody's talking about.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Readers, I don't know about you, but I firmly believe Tina Fey's portrayal of Sarah Palin was one reason Obama is now our president. However, before Weekend Update, before Sarah Palin, Tina Fey was just a young girl with a dream. A recurring dream that she was being chased through a local airport by her middle school gym teacher. And oh yes, she also had a dream that one day she would be a comedian on TV. At last, Tina Fey tells her story and narrates it herself in Bossy Pants. From her youthful days as a vicious nerd to her tour of duty on Saturday Night Live, from her passionately half-hearted pursuit of physical beauty to her life as a mother eating things off the floor, from her one-sided college romance to her nearly fatal honeymoon, from the beginning of this paragraph to the final sentence. Tina Fey reveals it all and proves what we've suspected all along. You're no one until someone calls you bossy. I think you're going to enjoy going behind the scenes at SNL and 30 Rock. Word of caution, Tina is not afraid to use, quote, some strong language, unquote. So best not to play this book in the car when the kids are along for the ride. Enjoy.
Welcome, friend. Congratulations on your purchase of this American-made genuine audiobook. Each component of this audiobook was selected to provide you with maximum audio performance, whatever your listening needs may be. If you're a woman and you bought this audiobook for practical tips on how to make it in a male-dominated workplace, here they are. No pigtails, no tube tops, cry sparingly. Some people say, never let them see you cry. I say, if you're so mad you could just cry, then cry. It terrifies everyone. When choosing sexual partners, remember, talent is not sexually transmittable. Also, don't eat diet foods in meetings. Perhaps you're a parent and you bought this audiobook to learn how to raise an achievement-oriented, drug-free adult virgin. You'll find that too. The essential ingredients, I can tell you up front, are a strong father figure, bad skin, and a child-sized colonial lady outfit. Maybe you bought this book because you love Sarah Palin and you want to find reasons to hate me. We've got that. I use all kinds of elitist words like impervious and gerund, and I think gay people are just as good at watching their kids play hockey as straight people. Maybe it's 70 years in the future and you found this audiobook in a stack of junk being used to block the entrance of an abandoned Starbucks that is now a feeding station for the alien militia. If that's the case, I have some questions for you, such as, did we really ruin the environment as much as we thought, and is Glee still a thing? If you're looking for a spiritual allegory in the style of C.S. Lewis, I guess you could piece something together with Lorne Michaels as a symbol for God and my struggles with hair removal as a metaphor for virtue. Or perhaps you just bought this audiobook to laugh and be entertained. For you, I have included this joke. Two peanuts were walking down the street.
and one was a salted peanut. You see, I just want you to get your money's worth. Anyone who knows me will tell you that I am all about money. I mean, just look how well my line of Zodiac-inspired toe rings and homeopathic children's medications are selling on Home Shopping Network. Because I am nothing if not an amazing businesswoman, I researched what kind of content makes for best-selling books. It turns out the answer is one-night stands, drug addictions, and recipes. Here, we are out of luck. But I can offer you lurid tales of anxiety and cowardice. Why is this audiobook called Bossy Pants? One, because the name Two and a Half Men was already taken. And two, because ever since I became an executive producer of 30 Rock, people have asked me, is it hard for you being the boss? And is it uncomfortable for you to be the person in charge? You know, in that same way they say, gosh, Mr. Trump, is it awkward for you to be the boss of all these people? I can't answer for Mr. Trump, but in my case, it is not. I've learned a lot in the past 10 years about what it means to be the boss of people. In most cases, being a good boss means hiring talented people and then getting out of their way. In other cases, to get the best work out of people, you may have to pretend you are not their boss and let them treat someone else like the boss, and then that person whispers to you behind a fake wall and you tell them what to tell the first person. Contrary to what I believed as a little girl, being the boss almost never involves marching around waving your arms and chanting, I am the boss, I am the boss. For me, this audiobook has been an almost pleasurable task of retracing my steps to figure out what factors contributed to this little soccer nerd developing into this fancy glamour lady who secretly prefers to be this weirdo on roller skates in a wig. For clarification, you can check the PDF. I hope you enjoy this audiobook. I hope you enjoy it so much that you also buy a copy for your sister-in-law. Sincerely, Tina Fey, New York City, 2011. It's so hard to believe it's 2011 already. I'm still writing Tina Fey, grade 4, room 207 on all my checks.
Holy Jimmy Choo, for crying out loud, Manolo. Am I the last one to realize that Candace Bushnell has a series out? The prequel to Sex and the City. To save you from my embarrassing fate, let's preview Summer in the City, a Carrie Diaries novel, book 2. It's summer in New York City, and Carrie is in love with all of it. The crazy characters in her neighborhood, the vintage clothing boutiques, the wild parties, the glamorous guys, all of it. Best of all, she's found a real writing class, taking her first steps towards fulfilling her dream. This sequel to The Carrie Diaries brings surprising revelations as Carrie learns to navigate her way around the Big Apple, growing into the person she'd always wanted to be, and realizing that that task is more complicated than she had ever imagined. Jenna LaMia narrates the story of how Carrie met Samantha and Miranda and what turned a small-town girl into our very own Carrie Bradshaw.
First, Samantha asks me to find her shoe. When I locate it in the sink, she asks me to a party. You might as well come, seeing as you don't have any place else to go and I don't feel like babysitting. I'm hardly a baby. Okay, you're a sparrow. Either way, she says, adjusting her silk bra as she wriggles into a green lycra shift. You've already been mugged. If you're kidnapped by a pimp, I don't want it on my hands. She spins around and eyes my outfit. A navy blue gabardine jacket with matching culottes that I'd actually considered chic a few hours ago. Is that all you've got? I have a black cocktail dress from the 1960s. Wear that. And put these on. She tosses me a pair of gold aviator sunglasses. They'll make you look normal. I don't ask what normal is as I follow behind her, clattering down the 5 flights of stairs to the street. Rule number 1, she declares, stepping into traffic. Always look like you know where you're going, even if you don't. She holds up her hand, causing a car to screech to a halt. Move fast! She bangs on the hood of the car and gives the driver the finger. And always wear shoes you can run in. I skittle behind her through the obstacle course of 7th Avenue and arrive on the other side like a castaway discovering land. And for God's sake, those wedge sandals? Out! Samantha decries, giving my feet a disparaging glance. Did you know that the first wedge sandal was invented by Ferragamo for the young Judy Garland? How on earth do you know that? I'm a font of useless information. Then you should do just fine at this party. Whose party is it again? I shout, trying to be heard over the traffic. David Ross, the Broadway director? Why is he having a party at 4 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon? I dodge a hot dog cart, a supermarket basket filled with blankets, and a child attached to a leash. It's a tea dance. Will they be serving tea? I can't tell if she's serious. She laughs. What do you think? The party is in a dusky pink house at the end of a cobblestoned street. I can see the river through a crack between the buildings, turgid and brown under glints of sunlight. David's very eccentric, Samantha warns, as if eccentricity might be an unwelcome trait to a new arrival from the provinces. Someone brought a miniature horse to his last party, and it crapped all over the Aubusson carpet. I pretend to know what an Aubusson carpet is in favor of learning more about the horse. How'd they get it there? Taxi, Samantha says. It was a very small horse. I hesitate. Will your friend David mind your bringing me? If he doesn't mind a miniature horse, I can't imagine he'll mind you. Unless you're a drag or a bore. I might be a bore, but I'm never a drag. And the stuff about coming from a small town, nix it, she says. In New York, you need a shtick. A shtick? Who you are, but better. Embellish, she says with a flourish as we pause in front of the house. It's 4 stories high, and the blue doors flung open in welcome, revealing a colorful throng, twirling and weaving like a chorus in a musical show. My insides throb with excitement. That door is my entrance to another world.
The Butterfly's Daughter by Mary Alice Munro brings us the legend of Las Mariposas, the beautiful monarch butterflies that fly more than 2,000 miles each year to return to their winter home in Mexico. Luz Avila learned of their ways and their mystical powers from her grandmother, the only family she ever knew. Now it is her turn, like the butterflies, to make that long, perilous journey. In order to honor a promise to her beloved abuela, Luz must return her grandmother's ashes to her ancestral village in the mountains of Mexico. The journey promises to bring deep spiritual meaning to the life of a woman who cannot find her way into the future until she comes to terms with the past. The book is read by the author.
Life cannot be renewed without sacrifice. Now I ask you, my daughter, mi preciosa, my young goddess, will you bring light to the world? 1. Each fall, millions of delicate orange and black butterflies fly more than 2,000 miles from the United States and Canada to overwinter in the mountains of central Mexico. The annual migration of the monarch is a phenomenal story, a miracle of instinct and survival. Esperanza Avila had told the story so many times over the years that it was accepted as truth, even by herself. She'd meant only to blanket her granddaughter's frightening loss, not to mislead her. She saw the story she'd created as a safe, happy cocoon for her to grow up in. But in the end, she'd created a lie. Now she was caught in her own trap of deception. The only way out was to tell Luz the truth, no matter how painful that truth might be. Esperanza counted the strokes as she brushed her long white hair in front of the bureau mirror. Morning light fell in a broken pattern across her room. Her gaze fell upon an old sepia-toned photograph of herself and her second husband, Hector Avila. She paused her brushing as she gazed at his brilliant smile, his hair that waved like the ocean he loved, and his eyes that were as impossibly blue. Hector Avila had been the love of her life, taken too soon from her. When she was a younger woman, her raven hair flowed down her back to swirl around her hips. Hector had loved her hair, whispered to her how it was like a waterfall at night that captured the reflection of the stars. He used to wind her hair in his hands, wrap himself up in it when they made love. Even after all these years, closing her eyes, she could remember the feel of his skin and her hair like silk pressed against her body. Opening her eyes again, she saw that her long hair was no longer the luster skein that Hector had relished. So many seasons had passed since those halcyon days, so many joys, and so much sadness. Her hair was a blizzard of snow falling around her shoulders. She pressed the brush to her heart as it tightened. Where did the time go? Suddenly, the room felt like it was tilting. Esperanza closed her eyes and grasped the bureau for balance. She was tired, she told herself. She didn't sleep well the night before. Ever since she'd received that phone call from her daughter Maria, old memories and worries had plagued her. They spilled over to her dreams, haunting her, and lingered after the pale light of dawn awakened her. Her troubled gaze traveled across the other photographs on her bureau, resting on a small silver frame that held the treasured photograph of her daughter, Mariposa, aglow with happiness. In her arms, she carried her baby. Luz couldn't have been 6 months old, but already her pale eyes shone as bright as the sun. Tears filled Esperanza's eyes as her heart pumped with love for this child, who had been a gift to her in her later years, after Mariposa had vanished. Hector, she said aloud, I need your wisdom now more than ever. I could bear this hardship alone, but Luz, she is 21, no longer a child. Still, I can't endure to see her hurt. I've told Luz so many stories about her mother, but now this, what words can I say to make her understand these truths? She shook her head with grief. How will she not hate me? She finished gathering her long locks and fingers that were gnarled from age and hard work. While she methodically wound the hair like a skein of wool, her mind reviewed her plan to tell Luz the truth about her mother.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Welcome, Mary Alice. It's so great to have you with us today.
Thank you. It's a joy to be with you.
All right. I know that we're going to talk about The Butterfly's Daughter, which is your 12th novel. Is that correct?
I think if you look at my children's book, it makes it Lucky 13.
All right. Lucky 13. What was the inspiration for this one about butterflies?
Well, I knew it, always knew someday I would write a book about butterflies, but the more that I learned about the monarch butterfly in particular, it became really clear that this was the one. I mean, it's the king, it's aptly named, the king of all butterflies. One, it's the only butterfly that migrates like a bird or a whale across this great country of ours. And in Florida, too, along, you know, there's an indigenous population, but it moves all through the coast, along the coast, to the overwintering grounds in Mexico. And that migration is so unique, and that's an endangered phenomenon. The second is that everyone knows the monarch. It's probably the most beloved butterfly. And the third is that most people don't realize that the monarch butterfly migrates these thousands of miles, but it's not the same butterfly that returns. It's the fourth generation monarch that makes the return journey. So the butterflies that are all coming up right now in the spring to repopulate our the Midwest and the Florida and all the way up to Canada, by the fourth generation, that little bug, that amazing little critter, is going to fly 2,000 plus miles to go to the overwintering grounds and live some 6-7 months. So when I had all this together, I knew that this would be an incredible story to tell.
Oh, now I know that you're an active conservationist, and your passion has come out in many of your novels. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes, I always look for some species to inspire me to write a novel. People don't read my books to, you know, learn about turtles or butterflies. I write a human story, and this is a beautiful story, for example, for the butterfly's daughter. It's a beautiful story of a young woman's journey, her connection to her grandmother, that very special relationship. And I wanted to write about grandmothers in particular and that what they share with us, and her mother. And so it's a very strong mother-daughter story. And I also wanted to bring out the human friendships that she forms along the way, much like the butterflies, you know, gather as they migrate. So I use nature as my source of inspiration to write a story. If anyone read The Beach House, for example, it's set against the loggerhead sea turtles, but everyone knows that's the story of Lovey and Kara, that very strong mother-daughter relationship, and her love affair with Brett. So I look at nature as my source, and then I find that it deepens and enriches all my thought, my themes, my metaphors, my characterizations.
Hmm. Well, I know that you grew up in the Chicago area, but now you're really classified as being a New South or a Low Country writer.
That's absolutely true. And I think that's because when I moved to South Carolina, I live on the barrier island, Isle of Palms. I was about 11 years ago, but I'd been coming 20 years before. It was only when my husband was able to, he's a psychiatrist, could work here full-time, that we were able to move here full-time. But most of my books, anyway, are set in the Low Country or in the South, because I, as a conservationist, as you mentioned, I see how precious these resources are and how quickly they can disappear. And also the passion most people have for learning about landscape. I was so amazed by my readers' reaction to my stories, that they love the human story. You know, either it's a love story or a mother-daughter story or the story of a long marriage. But they say, you know, when I finished your book, gosh, I learned an awful lot. And I think that transcends storytelling. That leaves my readers with that something extra when they finish a book.
And who of the Low Country writers or the New South, who do you admire? And is there a camaraderie amongst you? And
yes, you know, there's a really close bond between a lot of us here in the Low Country. I think the father of us all is Pat Conroy, who is he's a god in my book.
I met him at last year's Miami Book Fair, and what a guy, what a prince of a guy.
He is. He's as great a speaker as he is a writer, and that says a lot. But also, I think some of the really well-known Southern, Low Country authors in particular, but Southern, we stick around together. There's Dottie Frank, and then there's Patty Callahan Henry. Nicole Seitz, obviously Ann Rivers Siddons, but she's the grand dame of, she's equal to Pat in terms of the grand dame. And we just, so very supportive.
Yeah. And what about the New South? I mean, The Help is like at the top of all the charts for such a long time. I mean, is there a camaraderie among that group?
I think the New South for me is the writers, well, I can only speak for myself about that. I don't know Catherine Stockett, but I love her book. I have to say that for me, the reason I choose the landscape as my source of inspiration is because that is where a strong sense of place here in the South. But I think the danger of trivializing or romanticizing the South, the landscape, the people in it, the issues involved, is very dangerous. Because what I write about in The Butterfly's Daughter, for example, is the handing down of traditions and culture. cultural values and moral values from one generation to the next. This is where I think us as women, especially the mothers and grandmothers, where we live. You know, this is who we are, where we're from. And I think for the New South, the challenge is, and that I write about, is we have to ask the right questions to preserve what we treasure. And we welcome all those who join us in the South, myself included, and yet there's a responsibility to moving here, there's a responsibility for being born here to preserve not only our landscape but our traditions. Mm. That's the challenge of the New South.
Well, I know that you're on a very hectic book tour schedule right now, but are you already working on your next project?
I am. I'm writing a book that is the prequel of a very popular book of mine called The Beach House.
Yes.
The sequel to Swimming Lessons. It's a story that will always stay with me because I am a turtle lady, always will be. I still am licensed by DNR. And this is the story. I wanted to write the prequel because I wanted to compare the 1970s and 80s and the landscape and the very different world we lived here compared to today. And I think my readers will love that.
Yeah. Well, I have just a kind of off the beaten track question for you.
Yes.
I was reading in your bio, and you're a member of this GEMS group, people that share, women that share the same birthday. How did you find this group? I think it's a fabulous idea.
Yeah. It's one of the things I love about Charleston. We all, you know, it's a very small town. And my girlfriends, these are all girlfriends who just by coincidence, we knew each other. But all of a sudden we realized we all celebrated the same birthday within a day. Some of us the exact same day. And we're talking all of us, all four of us, the same year. Not just the same day, but the same year. So I just got to say, my girlfriends are going to Paris celebrate this birthday.
Yeah.
And I'm on book tour.
Oh.
So I'm going to celebrate my birthday with my readers.
Oh. Well, I love the idea. And your books really, really, really resonate. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, I enjoyed it very much. And thank you for the opportunity to speak to y'all.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Caterer and sleuth extraordinaire Goldie Schultz returns in Crunch Time, another tasty adventure from New York Times bestselling author Diane Mott Davidson. If you love detective stories and great cuisine, I'm guessing you may already be familiar with the series that Davidson keeps cooking up. In this title, Colorado caterer Goldie Schultz is trying to help her longtime friend and fellow chef Yolanda Garcia. When the rental house shared by Yolanda and her aunt is destroyed by arson, the pair move in with cop-turned-PI Ernest McLeod. But then Ernest is shot dead and his house is set on fire, nearly killing Goldie, Yolanda, and her aunt. Concerned for her friends, Goldie invites them to stay with her while the sheriff's department investigates. Yet even Goldie's house isn't safe. There's a failed break-in attempt by an unknown intruder. The intrepid Goldie steps up the investigation, but she's got to move fast. It's crunch time to close in on a killer before he can close in on her. Filled with danger as well as laughs, wonderful food, and scrumptious recipes, Crunch Time is a delicious indulgence to satisfy Goldie fans. And the icing on the cake? It's performed by one of my favorite narrators, Barbara Rosenblatt.
Yolanda was a hard worker, and I was happy to have her at my side. She inadvertently bumped into me when she was retrieving a bunch of fresh basil from the walk-in, a type of refrigerator every restaurant or serious caterer needs. She gave me a tentative smile, which I returned. At 35, Yolanda, a Cuban-American, was a knockout. She had unruly masses of curly russet hair, a stunning face, large chocolate eyes, and a figure most women wouldn't get without a trainer. At Andre's, the now defunct restaurant where we'd labored together years ago, at parties since then, and at the spa where Yolanda had worked until recently, I'd seen men give her looks of adoration. I always found this amusing, if somewhat deflating for yours truly, who was short and pudgy, with unremarkable brown eyes and unfashionably curly blonde hair. After several hours, we became so involved with our tasks that we didn't notice the weather turning blustery. despite the freeze we'd had the previous night. Only a few clouds had salted the sky that morning. Now, without warning, gray masses obscured the sun. I looked out the window and caught my own reflection. If I'd slimmed down a bit in the past few weeks, it was not from dieting, but from worry. Yes, indeed, worry, unease, apprehension. I had lots of those. I forced myself to put the anxiety aside as I checked the thermometer. The external temperature had dropped 20 degrees in less than an hour, from 70 degrees to 50. The fir and aspen that had drooped in the motionless air now slapped the sides of our two-story brown shingled house off Aspen Meadows Main Street. In the west, an ominous charcoal nimbus bloomed over the Continental Divide. Judging by the dark haze obscuring the highest peaks, it had already begun snowing above 12,000 feet. Hoping for a breath of coolness, I'd left some windows open when we started working. To me, the breeze was welcome, as the kitchen had become hot. The sudden scent of fall whisking through the house was as sweet as the cherries farmers sold off the backs of their trucks this time of year. When the wind became sharper, as it did before a storm, I actually laughed. Sudden blasts of cold air shrieked through the window jams. I should have paid more attention to Yolanda, who jumped every time a chilly blast made the house moan. But my friend quickly smoothed her face each time she was startled. I wondered briefly what was bothering her, then dismissed the thought. As if to calm her nerves, Yolanda ducked back into the walk-in. While I continued to knead the soft dough that would become loaves of Cuban bread, she brought out the last of the marinating pork shoulders, which she was about to roast. Our plan for the next morning, Monday, was to slice the bread and the pork for the sandwiches that would be the centerpiece of our buffet. They weren't strictly Cuban sandwiches, for which we would have needed several panini presses, mountains of cheese and ham, numerous jars of pickles, and a whole staff of cooks. But they would work for our guests. We were also serving prepared buffalo chicken wings and potato salad that my supplier had brought up from Denver the day before, plus sliced fruit and caprese salads served over tossed greens. For dessert, we were bringing cookies and fudge, lots and lots of both, because our clients were teenagers. The Christian Brothers High School had hired us to take the food down to Denver for lunch the next day. Although classes had started, scheduling glitches had prevented the school from administering the annual physicals required of students who played on or planned to try out for winter sports. These included basketball, ice hockey, and, most important from our family's perspective, fencing. On Monday, the teachers had had an in-service, and a full staff of medical personnel had agreed to come for 6 hours. My son Arch, who had turned 16 the previous April and now possessed growth spurt long arms and legs, had been on the varsity fencing team the previous year. I wanted to be supportive, but when you're the mother of an adolescent boy, it's hard to be helpful without your child acting as if you're driving him nuts.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Readers,
Are you familiar with the popular Maisie Dobbs series by Jacqueline Winspear? In A Lesson in Secrets, set in 1932, Maisie Dobbs' career takes a new turn when she accepts an undercover assignment directed by Scotland Yard's Special Branch and the Secret Police. Posing as a junior lecturer, Maisie is sent to the private college in Cambridge to monitor any activities not in the interests of His Majesty's government. When a controversial pacifist is murdered at the college, Maisie discovers the circumstances of that death appear linked to the suspicious comings and goings of faculty and students under her surveillance. To unravel this web, Maisie must overcome a reluctant Secret Service, discover shameful truths about Britain's conduct during the Great War, and face off against the rising powers of the Nazi Party in Britain. As the storm clouds of World War II gather on the horizon, this new chapter in the series will engage new listeners and loyal fans alike. It's read by Orla Cassidy.
Mrs. Bromley will take care of you. She's such a good cook. Every bit as good as... Frankie set down his mug with a thump that made Maisie start.
I can do for myself, Maisie, he sighed. Look, I'm happy for you, love. Really, I am. The old boy did well by you, and you deserve all that came to you. But I want to stay in my home, and I want to do my work, and I want to go on like I've been going on without any Mrs. Bromley putting food on the table for me. Now then.
Maisie stood up and walked to the kitchen sink. She rinsed her mug while looking out of the window and across the garden. Dad, I hate to say this, but you're being stubborn.
Well then, all I can say is that you know where you get it from, don't you?
They had parted on good enough terms, with Frankie giving his usual warnings for her to mind how she drove that motor car, and Maisie reminding him to take care. But as she replayed the conversation in her mind, along with those other conversations that had come to naught, she felt her heels dig in when she looked at the vehicle on her tail. She was damned if she would put up with some amateur following her for much longer. She wound down the window and gave a hand signal to indicate that she was pulling over to the side of the road, thus allowing the Austin 7 behind to pass, followed by the motor car that had been shadowing her for at least half an hour. As soon as they passed, she turned back onto the road again and began to drive as close to the vehicle in front as safety would allow. Now you know I know. Let's see what you do with it. She noted that there was no number plate on the black motor car and no other distinguishing marks. Both driver and passenger were wearing hats, and as their silhouettes moved, she could see the passenger looking back every so often. When they turned left, she turned left. And when they turned right, she followed. Soon they were back on the main road again, travelling up River Hill towards Seven Oaks. At the top, the Royal Automobile Club had stationed two men with water cans, ready to help motorists having trouble with overheated vehicles. It was a long hill, and on a hot day in August, many a steaming motor car lurched and rumbled its way to the brow, with the driver as glad to see the men from the RAC as a thirsty traveller might reach out towards an oasis in the desert. Allowing the black motor car to continue, she thought it was an Armstrong Siddeley. Maisie pulled in alongside the RAC motorbike and sidecar.
"Having a bit of trouble, love?"
"Not yet, but I thought I might get the water checked. It's a hot day." The man glanced down to the radiator grill and nodded when he saw the distinctive silver RAC badge with the Union Jack below the King's crown.
"Right you are, miss. Don't want to risk burning up a nice little runner like this, do you?"
Maisie smiled while keeping an eye on the road. Soon the Armstrong Siddeley approached the hill again, this time from the opposite direction, and as it passed, both driver and passenger made a point of looking straight ahead. Police, thought Maisie, sure of her assessment. I'm being followed by the police.
She didn't need much, but just as well you stopped, said the RAC man. Can't be too careful, not with this weather.
Thank you, sir. She reached into her shoulder bag for her purse and took out a few coins. I wonder, could you do me a favour? A black Armstrong Siddeley will presently be coming back up the hill. He's probably turning around at this moment. Could you pull it over for me? The man frowned, then smiled as he took the coins and looked in the direction Maisie indicated.
Is this the one?
coming along now?
Yes, that's it.
Maisie thought the man looked quite the authority as he stepped forward into the middle of the road in his blue uniform and peaked cap. He held up his hand as if he were a guard at a border crossing. The Armstrong Siddeley came to a halt, and Maisie stepped forward and tapped on the window. After a second or two, the driver wound down the window and Maisie leaned forward just enough to appear friendly, smiling as she affected a cut-glass, aristocratic tone. "Gentlemen, how lovely of you to stop when you must be so terribly busy." Her smile broadened. "Would it be too boring of me to ask why you've been following me? I think it might save on petrol and your time to explain your actions. After all, it's been over a week now, hasn't it?" The men exchanged glances, and the driver cleared his throat as he moved his hand towards his jacket pocket. Maisie reached forward and put her forefinger on his wrist.
One of the most prolific and wonderfully readable Irish authors you'll find is Maeve Binchy. In her newest title, Minding Frankie, she is back with a tale of joy, heartbreak, and hope about a motherless girl collectively raised by a close-knit Dublin community. When loner, and dare I say loser, Noel learns that his terminally ill casual gal pal is pregnant with his child, he agrees to take guardianship of the baby girl once she's born. But as a single father battling demons of his own, Noel can't do it alone. Yes, it takes a village. And in classic Binchy style, this village is a colorfully drawn cast of eccentric characters who weave in and out of each other's lives. The book is charmingly read by Sile Birmingham.
Katie said, "I have a cousin coming home from America for a few weeks. She mentioned that in America there are places where you could get your hair done for near to nothing cost if you were letting people practice on you. Well, we do have a student's night on Tuesdays. People bring in their own towels and we give them a style. They usually contribute €5 to a charity." "Tonight is Tuesday," the woman cried triumphantly. "So it is," Katie said through gritted teeth. "So, could I book myself in? I'm Josie Lynch." "Great, Mrs. Lynch. See you after 7 o'clock. Katie said, writing down the name. Her eyes met the priest's. There was sympathy and understanding there. It wasn't all champagne and glitter running your own hairdressing salon. Josie and Charles Lynch had lived in 23 St. Charlotte's Crescent since they were married 32 years ago. They had seen many changes in the area. The corner shop had become a mini supermarket. The old laundry, where sheets had been ironed and folded, was now a laundromat, where people left big bags bulky with mixed clothes and asked for a service wash. There was now a proper medical practice with 4 doctors, where once there had been just old Dr. Gillespie, who had brought everyone into the world and seen them out of it. During the height of the economic boom, houses in St. Charlotte's Crescent had changed hands for amazing sums of money. Small houses with gardens near the city centre had been much in demand. Not anymore, of course. The recession had been a great equaliser. But it was still a much more substantial area than it had been 3 decades ago. After all, just look at Molly and Paddy Carroll with their son Declan, a doctor. A real, qualified doctor. And just look at Mutty and Lizzie Scarlett's daughter Kathy. She ran a catering company that was hired for top events. But a lot of things had changed for the worse. There was no community spirit anymore. No church processions went up and down the crescent on the feast of Corpus Christi as they used to. Josie and Charles Lynch felt that they were alone in the world, and certainly in St. Charlotte's Crescent, in that they knelt down at night and said the rosary. That had always been the way. When they married, they planned a life based on the maxim that the family that prays together stays together. They had assumed they would have 8 or 9 children because God never put a mouth into this world that he didn't feed. But that wasn't to happen. After Noel, Josie had been told there would be no more children. It was hard to accept. They both came from big families. Their brothers and sisters had produced big families. But then, perhaps, it was all meant to be this way. They had always hoped Noel would be a priest. The fund to educate him for the priesthood was started before he was 3. Money was put aside from Josie's wages at the biscuit factory. Every week, a little more was added to the post office savings account. And when Charles got his envelope on a Friday from the hotel where he was a porter, a sum was also put into the post office. Noel would get the best of priestly educations when the time came. So it was with great surprise and a lot of disappointment that Josie and Charles learned that their quiet son had no interest whatsoever in a religious life. The brothers said that he showed no sign of a vocation, and when the matter had been presented to Noel as a possibility when he was 14, he had said, if it was the last job on earth, he wouldn't go for it. That had been very definite indeed. Not so definite, however, was what he actually would like to do. Noel was vague about this, except to say he might like to run an office. Not work in an office, but run one. He showed no interest in studying office management or bookkeeping or accounting or in any areas where the careers department tried to direct him. He liked art, he said, but he didn't want to paint. If pushed, he would say that he liked looking at paintings and thinking about them. He was good at drawing. He always had a notebook and a pencil with him, and he was often to be found curled up in a corner sketching a face or an animal.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need MagicBuzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The MagicBuzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. MagicBuzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at MagicBuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@MagicBuzz.com. MagicBuzz, we're there when you can't be.
The Queen of Suspense is back. Mary Higgins Clark's new novel, Her 30th, is about the most up-to-date of crimes, identity theft. Who hasn't read about or experienced the fear that someone else out there may be using your credit cards, accessing your bank account, even stealing your identity? In I'll Walk Alone, Alexandra Zan Moreland, a gifted, beautiful interior designer on the threshold of a successful Manhattan career, is terrified to discover that somebody is not only using her credit cards, but also manipulating her financial accounts to bankrupt her and destroy her reputation. They may also be impersonating her in a scheme that could involve kidnapping and murder. Zan is already haunted by the disappearance of her own son, Matthew, kidnapped in broad daylight 2 years ago in Central Park, a tragedy that has left her torn between hope and despair. Now, on what would be Matthew's 5th birthday, photos surface that seem to show Zan kidnapping her own child. Hounded by the press, under investigation by the police, attacked by both her angry ex-husband and a vindictive business rival, Zan sets out to discover who is behind this cruel hoax. The book is read by Jan Maxwell.
Father Aidan O'Brien was hearing confessions in the lower church of St. Francis of Assisi on West 31st Street in Manhattan. The 78-year-old Franciscan friar approved of the alternate way of administering the sacrament, that of having the penitent sit in the reconciliation room with him, rather than kneeling on the hard wood of the confessional with a screen hiding his or her identity. The one time he felt the new way did not work was when, sitting face to face, he sensed that the penitents might not be able to allow themselves to say what might have been confided in darkness. This was happening now on this chilly, windswept afternoon in March. In the first hour he had sat in the room, only two women had shown up, regular parishioners, both in their mid-80s, whose sins, if any had ever existed, were long behind them. Today, one of them had confessed that when she was 8 years old, she remembered telling a lie to her mother. She had eaten two cupcakes and blamed her brother for the missing one. As Father Aidan was praying his rosary until he was scheduled to leave the room, the door opened, and a slender woman who looked to be in her early 30s came in. Her expression tentative, she moved slowly toward the chair facing him and hesitantly sat down on it. Her auburn hair was loose on her shoulders. Her fur-collared suit was clearly expensive, as were her high-heeled leather boots. Her only jewelry was silver earrings. His expression serene, Father Aidan waited. Then, when the young woman did not speak, he asked encouragingly,
"How can I help you?"
"I don't know how to begin." The woman's voice was low and pleasant, with no hint of a geographical accent.
"There's nothing you can tell me that I haven't already heard," Father Aidan said mildly.
The woman paused, then the words came rushing out. "I know about a murder that someone is planning to commit, and I can't stop it." Her expression horrified, she clasped her hand over her mouth and abruptly stood up.
"I should never have come here," she whispered.
Then, her voice trembling with emotion, she said,
"Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. I confess that I am an accessory to a crime that is ongoing and to a murder that is going to happen very soon. You'll probably read about it in the headlines. I don't want to be a part of it, but it's too late to stop."
She turned and in five steps had her hand on the door.
"Wait," Father Aidan called, trying to struggle to his feet. "Talk to me. I can help you."
But she was gone.
Was the woman psychotic? Father Aidan wondered. Could she possibly have meant what she said? And if so, what could he do about it? "If she was telling the truth, I can do nothing about it," he thought, as he sank back into the chair. "I don't know who she is or where she lives. I can only pray that she is irrational and that this scenario is some kind of fantasy. But if she is not irrational, she is shrewd enough to know that I am bound by the seal of the confessional. At some point, she may have been a practicing Catholic. The words she used, 'Bless me, Father, for I have sinned,' was the way a penitent used to begin to confess."
For long minutes, he sat alone. When the woman exited, the green light over the reconciliation room door had automatically gone on, which meant that anyone waiting outside would have been free to enter. He found himself praying fervently that the young woman might return, but she did not. He was supposed to leave the room at 6 o'clock, but it was 6:20 when he gave up hope that she might come back. Finally, aware of the weight of his years and the spiritual burden of his role as confessor, Father Aidan placed both hands on the arms of his chair and got up slowly, wincing at the sharp thrust of pain in his arthritic knees. Shaking his head, he began to walk to the door, but stopped for a moment in front of the chair where the young woman had been sitting.
"She wasn't crazy," he thought sadly. "I can only pray that if she really has knowledge that the crime of the murder is about to be committed..."
So, does the end justify the means? Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, written by Amy Chua and narrated by her, is an honest and sometimes hilarious story of one mother's exercise in extreme parenting, revealing the rewards and the costs of raising her children the Chinese way. As you can imagine, lots of book clubs are discussing this one. All parents want to do what's best for their children. What Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother reveals is that the Chinese just have a totally different idea of how to do that. Western parents respect their children's individuality, or try to. The Chinese believe the best way to protect your child is by preparing them for the future and arming them with skills, strong work habits, and inner confidence. Chua's daughters, Lulu and Sophia, never have time for a play date. They're too busy studying Mandarin or practicing their instruments 2 to 3 hours a day and double sessions on the weekend. Extreme? You bet. But Chua demands as much of herself as she does of her daughters. And in her sacrifices, the exacting attention spent studying her daughter's performances, the office hours lost shuttling the girls to lessons, the depth of her love for her children becomes clear. This is an eye-opening exploration of the differences in Eastern and Western parenting and the lessons parents and children everywhere teach one another.
A lot of people wonder how Chinese parents raise such stereotypically successful kids. They wonder what these parents do to produce so many math whizzes and music prodigies, what it's like inside the family, and whether they could do it too. Well, I can tell them, because I've done it. Here are some things my daughters, Sophia and Luisa, were never allowed to do. Attend a sleepover. Have a play date. Be in a school play. Complain about not being in a school play. Watch TV or play computer games. Choose their own extracurricular activities. Get any grade less than an A. Not be the number one student in every subject except gym and drama. Play any instrument other than the piano or violin. Not play the piano or violin. I'm using the term Chinese mother loosely. I recently met a super successful white guy from South Dakota. You've seen him on television. And after comparing notes, we decided that his working-class father had definitely been a Chinese mother. I know some Korean, Indian, Jamaican, Irish, and Ghanaian parents who qualify too. Conversely, I know some mothers of Chinese heritage, almost always born in the West, who are not Chinese mothers, by choice or otherwise. I'm also using the term Western parents loosely. Western parents come in all varieties. In fact, I'll go out on a limb and say that Westerners are far more diverse in their parenting styles than the Chinese. Some Western parents are strict, others are lax. There are same-sex parents, Orthodox Jewish parents, single parents, ex-hippie parents, investment banker parents, and military parents. None of these Western parents necessarily see eye to eye, so when I use the term Western parents, of course I'm not referring to all Western parents, just as Chinese mother doesn't refer to all Chinese mothers. All the same, even when Western parents think they're being strict, they usually don't come close to being Chinese mothers. For example, my Western friends who consider themselves strict make their children practice their instruments 30 minutes every day, an hour at most. For a Chinese mother, the first hour is the easy part. It's hours 2 and 3 that get tough. Despite our squeamishness about cultural stereotypes, there are tons of studies out there showing marked and quantifiable differences between Chinese and Westerners when it comes to parenting. In one study of 50 Western American mothers and 48 Chinese immigrant mothers, almost 70% of the Western mothers said either that stressing academic success is not good for children, or that parents need to foster the idea that learning is fun. By contrast, roughly 0% of the Chinese mothers felt the same way. Instead, the vast majority of the Chinese mothers said that they believe their children can be the best students, that academic achievement reflects successful parenting, and that if children did not excel at school, then there was a problem and parents were not doing their job.
Wow, romance, suspense, celebrities, parenting? There is such a broad spectrum of new titles to choose from. One great way to keep up to date is to check my website, www.bookreportradio.com. You'll find a list of all the books we cover there. Readers, thanks so much for joining me today, and see you back here next week for The Book Report. It's too late.